The headlines: Lebanon forms a new government after being run by a caretaker government for over a year. Israeli soldiers injure dozens of Palestinians during protests across the occupied territories in solidarity with their fellow Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. And the number of coronavirus cases and deaths keeps declining in Iran as the government accelerates vaccinations across the country. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Lebanon has announced the formation of a new government under Najib Mirati in an attempt to put an end to the country's months-long political deadlock. Lebanon's President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Najib Mirati officially signed the decree to form the new government on Friday. The presidency said in a statement that the decree was signed in the presence of Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri. The new cabinet consists of 24 members. Walid Fayyad has been designated Energy and Water Minister, while Mori Selim will take the helm of the Defense Ministry. Mirati was tasked with forming a new government in July. Lebanon has been run by a caretaker administration led by Hassan Diab since last August. The country is grappling with a deep financial crisis worsened by a political deadlock. The Israeli army has made more arrests over the Monday jailbreak of six Palestinians from a high-security prison of the regime. Two brothers and a sister of suspected mastermind Mahmoud Arda were detained near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. Other relatives of the six fugitives, all from the Jenin area, were arrested on Wednesday. They are now all in detention. A massive manhunt is also underway in the occupied territories. The six Palestinians escaped from Gilboa prison through a tunnel dug beneath a sink in a cell. Israel has decided to relocate inmates following the jailbreak. Israeli forces have injured dozens of Palestinians during protests across the occupied territories in solidarity with their fellow Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. The regime forces attacked protesters in Beita near the city of Nablus using rubber bullets and tear gas. Palestinians in Al-Quds gathered at Al-Aqsa Mosque condemning the regime's repression inside prisons. Similar protests were also held in the town of Araba near Jenin. People in the besieged Gaza Strip also offered Friday prayers in front of the Red Cross headquarters to express their support for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Palestinian resistance factions had called for a day of rage on Friday against Israel's decision to relocate inmates. Israel is using heavy-handed tactics against inmates and their families since six Palestinians escaped from the regime's high-security prison. Our correspondent Mona Kandil is joining us now from Ramallah. Mona, welcome to the program. Talk to us more about the Israeli forces' heavy-handed tactics against Palestinians in the West Bank following the jailbreak from the Israeli Gilboa prison.
Well, Palestinians took to the streets for following the Friday prayers in several areas in the occupied West Bank. In the first place, to send a message that they will do their utmost to protect those six Palestinian prisoners who succeeded to get out from Gilboa prison last Monday, as well as to support the Palestinian prisoners calling for an end of the Israeli military illegal measures against thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, because the Israeli guards are punishing the Palestinian prisoners for what the six other prisoners had done. Demonstrations took place. Let's speak about a protest in the village of Beita near Nablus, as well as Beit Dajan also in Nablus. At least 40 Palestinians were wounded during these two demonstrations, where the Israeli forces fired heavy tear gas, stun grenades, as well as rubber-coated bullets to disperse the protesters, also injuring a Palestinian journalist who was there, shooting him in the chest. In Beit Umar town, in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, southern the occupied West Bank, Palestinians have also protested following the Friday prayers, and clashes took place between the Palestinian youths and the Israeli forces in Al-Khalil. Elsewhere, Palestinian factions, Islamic and national powers have called for Friday to be a day of rage. However, such protests have taken place, but there are calls for not maybe demonstrations. However, family members of those six Palestinians who succeeded to get out of Gilboa prison, many of them had been arrested by the Israeli forces. Today, some were released, but the Israeli authorities informed them that they are not allowed to speak to the journalists, they are not allowed to receive guests or any form of celebrations, and if they hold hold any kind of celebrations or any form of celebrations, they would be again arrested. The Israeli regime also warned family members of the six Palestinian prisoners that they must inform the Israeli regime of anything they know about their family members. However, they would be or they would be arrested by the Israeli regime.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona Kandil, joining us from Ramallah.
Hello and welcome to a special news segment coming to you live from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. My name is Amin Alemi. Concerns are mounting over the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan as funds remain frozen in the wake of the Taliban takeover of the country. The UN has warned of an economic collapse here. It says the world has a duty to extend solidarity to Afghanistan, where millions risk dying of hunger.
Fears are growing over the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan, where a new government is being formed under the Taliban rule, a group not yet recognized by the international community. The UN chief has called for maintaining a dialogue with the Taliban to avoid an economic collapse he says could lead to millions of deaths.
Naturally, the Taliban want to be recognized. They want the sanctions to be lifted. They want financial support, and this gives the international community some leverage. I think that naturally we don't have an internationally recognized government yet, but I also think that we have to avoid an economic collapse situation, which could create appalling humanitarian consequences for the Afghan people.
The UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan has also warned of humanitarian impacts if funds remain frozen in the aftermath of the Taliban takeover of the country.
Assets and dollar and donor funds have been frozen by members of the international community. The understandable purpose is to deny these funds to the de facto Taliban administration. The inevitable effect, however, will be a severe economic downturn that could throw many more millions into poverty and hunger, may generate a massive wave of refugees from Afghanistan, and indeed set Afghanistan back for generations.
Afghanistan's neighbors are also worried about the humanitarian situation there. Iran's permanent representative to the UN says Afghanistan's dire situation is a direct result of the 20-year U.S. war there.
Hundreds of thousands of Afghans have fled their country. Nearly 600,000 of others have become internally displaced. Essential food supplies are running short, and 18.4 million people need humanitarian assistance. This situation is primarily the direct result of the intervention by the United States and other foreign forces in Afghanistan and their irresponsible withdrawal.
The U.S. fully withdrew from Afghanistan by August 31st, 2 weeks after the Taliban swept to power. The pullout ended the U.S. military presence, criticized for failing to restore peace in Afghanistan. Washington is now facing calls by humanitarian groups to unfreeze funds parked in the U.S. as part of sanctions against the Taliban. Food and fuel prices are already soaring in Afghanistan amid a shortage of cash, partly triggered by the U.S. halt in dollar shipments. Aid groups say the cost of economically pressuring the new Afghan rulers is the lives of millions of ordinary people already bearing the brunt of 20 years of U.S. occupation.
The United States has praised the Taliban for facilitating the forced evacuation of Americans from Afghanistan after the U.S. withdrew. The White House said the departure from Kabul to Doha on chartered Qatar Airways flight marked a positive first step with the new government. It said the Taliban have been cooperative and businesslike and shown flexibility at the matter. Nearly 40 U.S. citizens or permanent residents were invited to board the Thursday flight, but only 21 were on board. The United States had previously said a little more than 100 Americans remained in Afghanistan after Washington fully withdrew on August 31st. A U.S. media poll says many Americans believe that events after September 11, 2001 had a more negative than a positive impact on the country. According to the survey conducted by Washington Post and ABC News, 46% of the people say the events of 9/11 changed the country for the worse, while 33% believe they changed the country for the better. That represents a large swing from the first anniversary of the attack in 2002. Back then, 55% said the country had changed for the better. Nearly 3,000 people were killed on 9/11, when hijacked airplanes smashed into the World Trade Center towers in New York. 15 of the 19 hijacks were Saudi citizens. Political analyst Leanne Williams says the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks was a disproportionate. Let's listen to what he has to say.
The reaction in Afghanistan was completely disproportionate. The small group of people who conducted these raids were, as you pointed out, more closely related to the Saudis than to the Afghans. And when the army did go in there, into Afghanistan, which allegedly was the cause and the root of the terrorists, they didn't go with huge armies. They used mercenaries. They used warlords. They used people. Well, they were used war criminals, basically, and they were paid for from CIA funds to get rid of the Taliban, while the main military force and money was spent in Iraq, which was completely unrelated. I mean, what could go wrong by hitting the wrong target with the wrong forces while, you know, and ignoring the real target?
Well, that's it from me here in Kabul. Now, let's go back to Badi Ahunardar in Tehran for the rest of the news.
Thanks a lot. I mean, that was very own man, Amin Alami, out in the Afghan capital, Kabul. We're going to return now to our top story for the program, where Lebanon has announced the formation of a new government under Najib Mirati in an attempt to put an end to the country's months-long political deadlock. Our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, is joining us now from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mariam, what are some of the immediate challenges in store for a new government in Lebanon?
Well, the challenges are many. We're talking about economic, financial, monetary, social, even now security challenges that this government is facing in light of the crisis that people are living through. Prime Minister Najib Mikati has stressed that he will try to deal with all these issues. But the formation of the cabinet itself is something that is positive. It is one of the first steps that we needed to take. We saw how it was encouraged by most of the political factions, even by foreign groups. We saw the French pushing for a government very strongly, even trying to get acceptance from or getting approval and support from the Americans. The Americans had seemed to have vetoed such a cabinet. However, with the what seems to be a really dire situation where there's no fuel, no electricity, no medicine, and we saw with Hezbollah's initiative of bringing in fuel from the Islamic Republic of Iran, we saw that change in the international, the Western method in Lebanon and how they helped or pushed for this cabinet. And at the same time, there were issues that were tied inside the country with issues related to, of course, for example, the sectarian balance in the cabinet, which is part of the national charter, and the fact that this needed all the ministers need approval from the factions that are the strongest in the parliament. We're talking about the faction that is mostly supportive of President Michel Aoun, Hezbollah, the Yamal movement, and their allies, and you also have the major groups like the Future Movement and the former prime ministers, the friends, if we may say, of former Prime Minister Saad Hariri and Fuad Sanura. So they also had a say. We had some other groups that were blocking, that were pushing. for a new parliamentary elections. However, this did not happen because as long as the term of the president continues, then therefore there needs to be a cabinet. This cabinet is supposed to serve for around 8 months, so therefore it does not have enough time to really put in long-term solutions or long-term objectives. What it can do is try to solve or fill in the gaps of the things that it can do quickly, some quick fixes here and there, some solutions, perhaps bringing in more funds from the International Monetary Fund. As you know, these were stalled after the resignation of the Hassan Diab government. So therefore, you have issues that are in the drawer that can be done real quickly. You also have issues that were already prepared by the previous cabinet concerning, for example, the ration card or the social welfare card for those families that are in dire need, that are in below the poverty line. So that needs to be some of the first few things that this government implements in order to try to stop this collapse. And this is what we heard from Prime Minister Najib Mikati.
All right, thanks a lot, Mayam. We're going to leave it there. That was our correspondent, Mayam Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Elsewhere, the number of coronavirus cases and deaths is declining in Iran as the government accelerates vaccinations across the country. Iran's health ministry reported some 21,000 new cases in the past 24 hours until Friday. The ministry also said that 445 more people died in the same time, bringing the total fatalities in the country to over 113,000. The vaccination drive in the country is also gathering pace as more than 30 million doses of vaccines have been injected so far. More than 240 towns and cities across the nation are currently categorized as very high-risk locations in terms of the coronavirus infection. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of our weekly series, Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, we're in the process of explaining Surah Hujurat, which is the 49th in the serial order of compilation of the Holy Quran. We continue from where we left off last week, and here is Ayah 10 of Surah Hujurat.
إنما المؤمنون إخوة فأصلحوا بين أخويكم واتقوا الله لعلكم ترحمون.
The faithful are indeed brothers. Therefore make peace between your brothers and be wary of Allah so that you may receive His mercy. If you might recall last Friday in our explanation of the previous ayah of this surah, we pointed out that sometimes clashes occur among individuals or groups of society, and in such cases it is but natural for each party to seek help from its friends. The Holy Quran stresses that fellow Muslims ought not to be mere onlookers in such cases, but should mediate peace between the conflicting groups. We also said that everyone is responsible towards peace, stability and security of society. Hence, they cannot be indifferent and should strive to remove friction. The ayah, which we just recited to you, now establishes the bond of brotherhood among the true believers as among the honors of Islam. It treats the relationship amongst believers like that between brothers, since friendship between two brothers is deeply rooted and firm. It is bilateral rather than unilateral, and is based on innate nature and disposition rather than on worldly and mundane appeals. Islam advises Muslims to stand above all superficial differences such as ethnic, racial, linguistic, geographical, or color of skin, so that nobody would consider themselves superior to others. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, established the bond of brotherhood among his companions. He used to emphasize, "There is no superiority for Arabs over non-Arabs, or for the white over the black, and all are brothers and creatures of God." Thus, according to this ayah, all true believers are like brethren, and all contentions and conflicts amongst brethren ought to be replaced by peace and sincerity. This is humanism in the best sense of the word, since Muslim brotherhood is the greatest social ideal known to society. This ayah teaches us, 1. In Islam, all believers are equal without any superiority over others. And 2, it is incumbent to make peace between brothers by removing differences. And 3, peace leads to harmony and results in divine mercy. Now let us listen to Ayah 11 of Surah Hujurat.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu la yaskhar qawmun min qawmin asa an yakunu khayran minhum wala nisa'un min nisa'a wala nisa'un min نِسَاءٍ عَسَى أَنْ يَكُنَّ خَيْرًا مِنْهُنَّ وَلَا تَلْمِزُوا أَنْفُسَكُمْ أنفسكم ولا تنابزوا بالألقاب بئس الاسم الفسوق بعد الإيمان ومن لم يتب فأولئك هم الظالمون.
O you who have faith, let not any people ridicule another people. It may be that they are better than they are. Nor let women ridicule women. It may be that they are better than they are. And do not defame one another, nor insult one another by calling nicknames. How evil are profane names subsequent to faith. And whoever is not penitent, such are the wrongdoers. This ayah is continuation of the previous one and stresses that no man or woman is allowed to mock others. Moreover, no one should call others by improper names or nicknames. It is a sin for such a person not to repent, and whoever is not a penitent is a wrongdoer. It is important to note that mutual ridicule ceases to be fun when there is arrogance or selfishness or malice or contempt behind it. We may laugh with people, but we must never laugh at people to disgrace or dishonor them. Defamation may consist in speaking ill of others by the spoken or written word, or in acting in such a way as to hurl a negative charge. A biting remark or taunt or sarcasm is included in the Arabic word lamaza, as used by the Holy Quran. An offensive nickname may amount to defamation. This ayah teaches us the following points. 1. Faith in God does not comply with ridiculing others. 2. Ridiculing other individuals or ethnicities is a sign of superciliousness. The Holy Quran has strongly opposed this habit, saying the ones who are ridiculed may be better than those who ridicule. And 3. Among the strategic goals of Islam is to build a sound and healthy society devoid of evil behaviors. Now let us listen to Ayah 12 of Surah Hujurat as the concluding ayah of this week's program.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu jtanibu kathiran minal dhanni inna ba'dal dhanni ithm. Wala tajassasu wala yaghtab ba'dukum ba'da. أيحب أحدكم أن يأكل لحم أخيه ميتا فكرهتموه واتقوا الله إن الله تواب رحيم.
O you who have faith, avoid much suspicion. Indeed, some suspicions are sins. And do not spy or backbite one another. Will any of you eat the flesh of his dead brother? You would hate it. And be wary of Allah. Indeed, Allah is all clement, all merciful. This ayah mentions three causes of undermining brotherhood in society. Unfortunately, some people are suspicious of others. This makes them spy on others, and may also make them backbite. Backbiting means saying something about somebody that will upset him or her if she or he hears it. This ayah likens backbiting to eating the flesh of one's dead brother. Thus, most kinds of suspicion are baseless, and some are crimes in themselves. Therefore, conjecture, or qiyas, has been outlawed in Islam. Spying into other people's affairs means either idle curiosity or suspicion carried a stage further. Backbiting is mischievous. And if poisoned with malice, it is a sin added to sin. It is like eating the flesh of a dead brother, which is abomination plus abomination. The Holy Prophet has remarked, Backbiting is worse than adultery because Allah may forgive an adulterer or adulteress if he or she turns repentant to him. But pardon for backbiting is not available until the aggrieved person agrees to forgive. From this ayah, we learn that 1. In an Islamic society, people live on the basis of goodwill and trust one another. 2. Suspicion sets the ground for spying and eventually backbiting. And 3. Some of the sins are so grave that the Holy Quran points to their inward reality. Backbiting is one such sin. It is like eating the flesh of one's dead brother, because a dead person cannot defend against defaming and losing face. And 4. There is no dead end in Islam. Penitence can remove all sins, as God is all-merciful and accepts repentance.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
Imam Zain al-Abidin was not just ill in bed, and the Ahlul Bayt were not just being carried from city to city. They were on a mission. The enemies, from their perspective, they're taking them to show them off in city to city, as war captives, as Kharijis, those who've left Islam, and to show off their victory. The mission of the Ahlul Bayt is to use this to show how wrong Yazid is and that this is not Islam. Use what they want to use. This is a clear instance of وَمَكَرُوا وَمَكَرَ اللَّهُ وَاللَّهُ خَيْرُ الْمَاكِرِينَ. By the instruction of the Imam, these women and children that were being shown off as a sign of victory became evidence for a crime. Eventually, Yazid wants to wash this crime off. They realize when it's too late, they took them from city to city as their own doing. He shouldn't have taken them to Sham. He brought them to Sham for his purposes with the leadership of Imam Zain al-Abidin. The scene flipped. Instead of this being a show of victory, showing these people as a sign that we destroyed our opponents, it became evidence for great sin and crime that he himself has shown to everyone. Now he can't hide it anymore. This is the work of Imam Zain al-Abidin. So they weren't just carried around. They did something, right? And it's hard work, trust me. If you think Karbala is difficult, the women who have suffered those losses, who are now being beaten, pushed around, the way they are treated, carried on bare camels, they are being humiliated. Every action is being taken to humiliate them. Their job is first and foremost not to be humiliated one bit. But was it a failure for Islam? Did Islam lose? No. If you're doing jihad in the way of Allah against those who are working against Islam, against Allah, against the right religion, against justice, if you're doing that jihad, even if there are times where people are captured, people are imprisoned, people are killed, resources are taken away, embargoes are enforced, sanctions are enforced, none of that is a failure. Shaitan wants to make you feel that that's a failure. Once you think it's a failure, it becomes that much harder to get back up to continue. And so, and sometimes it's not seeing that as a failure, it's just that we just lose focus when it's a severe condition, pain, loss of life. We just lose focus altogether. We're just so consumed by the loss, whatever it may be. The loss of a leader, the loss of a family member, the loss of whoever. We have that loss, we're just so consumed by it, we're not even thinking about anything. That just not slows us down, it paralyzes us. We can't continue on the path of Ashura and Karbala. Eventually, like, you know what, I can't deal with this. There's no use. You do something, they imprison the couple of guys who were leading it, that's it. That's gone. Look at Malcolm X, the Shaheed of this country, the one Shaheed that I know of. There are probably multiple Shuhada here. But one Muslim Shaheed that we know of is Malcolm X. Allah bless his soul. This truth seeker with the courage to say the truth the way it is, as far as he understood. People that are around him, oh yeah, this great figure, what happened? They assassinated him. People around him, when he's assassinated, what happens? The whole thing dies. You give up. You lose them all. Yeah, best we can do is do something like that, and then they kill that person. They created this organization, that organization. I won't name them. Go read. Different organizations that have been predominantly in the black community, as they have been the primary mustadhafin that are visible, the mustadhafin of this country who are not even visible, the Native Americans, I'm not too aware of. There, I know some things, but organizations and so on, I'm not aware of. In the black community, you've had these figures, leaders, organizations created, and they're infiltrated. The heads are assassinated, others are incarcerated. Like, what's the use? You know, this has been going on for so long. You do this, you speak, yeah, Shaykh, you're right, that's right, these are tawaghi, but what can we do? You do this, this is what happens. A few people get killed, let us just continue having our majalis without mentioning these things. Let's just forget about that stuff. That's giving up. Imam Zain al-Abidin teaches us that if something as bad as Karbala occurs to you and your family, which that combines everything. A great leader was lost. A great father was lost. Fathers were lost. Brothers, great brothers were lost. Even if you're in that position, you don't quit. You don't stop. You don't even slow down. You focus on your taklif. What was that jihad in the way of Allah? Before the day of Ashura, our responsibility was to do ABC, prepare for getting rid of Yazid. When we saw that nobody is coming, that's not possible. Prepare for Shahada, those of us who are, and those of us who survive, now prepare to make sure that this is recorded as it was, and this becomes a movement that gives courage to people for the rest of time. Shows the people this is not Islam for the rest of time. Shows the people that Islam is in the household of the Prophet for the rest of time. This is our jihad. Focus on it and carry it out perfectly. And we hope that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala helps us with that. It's definitely much easier said than done. We have not had these things happen to us. Some people have, but a lot of us, most of us as far as I know, we haven't had this happen to us. A close family member. Something that affects us personally because of the struggle. much less to experience something even close to Karbala. Look at what Imam Zain al-Abidin did, Salamullah alayhi. But look what Zainab, Salamullah alayha, did, continuing that struggle. It really is amazing. It's extraordinary. It's something that if we are able to see the conduct of them and understand what they did, realize the strength of these women and children under the leadership of Imam Zain al-Abidin, that they're able to accomplish that. Salamullah alayhim ajma'in. Sallallahu alayk, ya Abu Abdullah.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As the Delta variant continues to rage in the United States, maxing out many of the nation's intensive care units, Americans face a severe deficit in direct care nurses and caregivers in their hospitals. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Judy Sheridan Gonzalez, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. For-Profit Health System is Worsening a Nursing Shortage Amid Delta Surge. Stay tuned for more. As the Delta variant continues to rage in the United States, maxing out many of the nation's intensive care units, Americans face a severe deficit in direct care nurses and caregivers in their hospitals. Since 2016, hospitals have turned over an average of 90.8% of their staff, including registered nurses, RNs. Some hospitals have annual RN vacancy rate hovering well beyond 20%. But the number actually needed to provide safe care is often double or even triple the number of budgeted vacant positions. While there has been no shortage of students wishing to study to become nurses, nursing programs across the country are closing, even as demand for nurses continues to rise. In New York State alone, more than 170 nursing programs closed over the past 20 years, with only 65 accredited nursing schools remaining. We'll be right back. What are the conditions driving RN turnover and vacancy rates, and what can we do to bring on and keep more qualified nurses in the field? While salaries and benefits in union-dense regions of New York State have improved, they have still remained substandard in other states. In non-union and even some unionized hospitals in these states, the cost of health benefits outweighs salaries. Nurses must resort to taxpayer-funded state government system for their dependents. Ironically, these hospitals which receive state subsidies are relieved of the cost of insuring their employees, while additional state funds are expended for this purpose. Defined benefit pensions have been discarded by many hospitals and replaced with defined contribution plans that are dependent upon the stock market and offer far less protection to retirees. Travel nurses, on the other hand, can earn over $5,000 per week plus housing, transportation, and food. When hospitals run out of enough nurses to keep patients alive, they resort to paying these costs as well as travel nurses' lucrative agency fees. Nurses often choose to leave hospital staff and opt for these assignments in various locations in order to make more money, travel, and avoid the torments of staff nurse positions in uncaring facilities. In the U.S. hospitals, 23.9% of all new RNs leave within a year. Each percent change in RN turnover costs the average hospital an additional $270,800 each year. Ultimately, chronic understaffing and unacceptable working conditions are the main reason new nurses leave the bedside. Senior nurses retire early and others shop around or leave the profession entirely. Nurses have been saying for years that they must have a standard of care that includes minimum nurse-to-patient ratios in order to deliver the kind of care they would want for their patients. Often based on U.S. professional judgment, we know that nurses can safely care for 2, 3, or 4 patients depending upon severity and complexity of illness. Yet, they're told instead that they are responsible for double, triple, or even quadruple that number of human beings, leading nurses to decompensate. The SARS-CoV-2 pandemic didn't initiate the nursing shortage, but it did exacerbate the problem and made the public painfully aware of its seriousness. This shortage is manufactured by an inflated, top-heavy healthcare system built on profit-making rather than enhancing care. Dollars in hospitals are spent on consultants, marketers, information technology, streamliners, and overpaid managers whose job it is to cut off staff and work nurses beyond human capacity. That doesn't even touch the money lining the pockets of insurers, big pharma, and other predators of the healthcare system. Money that could otherwise be spent on staff training and preventative care for patients. In addition, the frenzied competition and breakneck efforts of hospitals to make a buck result in overtreating the well-insured and undertreating the underinsured and the uninsured, leading to negative outcomes and complications. Nurses are pressured to reduce length of stay and often have to take on hospital and insurance administration to advocate for patients staying an extra day to recuperate.
As the pandemic continues to rage amid the Delta variant spread, patients in already overcrowded, understaffed, and poorly prepared environments are still dying by the thousands. However, even in the face of this horrific medical nightmare, there was a potential to save so many more. The death toll and the conditions New York nurses faced in March and April 2020 left nurses numb. Many of Americans developed an almost collective amnesia about what occurred, just so they could continue on. Post-traumatic stress disorder is rampant among the medical community. And now, with numbers rising in intensive care units once again, it has become almost too much to bear. What's worse, the flip-flopping and crass abandonment of caregivers by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and American employers at the start of the pandemic resulted in a form of trauma betrayal, leaving people in caregiving professions skeptical about believing anything else the government promotes, including vaccines. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein brought his dear ones to Karbala to clarify the truth. December 13, 2009. Imam Hussein brought his dear ones to the desert of Karbala in order to clarify the truth. He knew what was going to happen, yet he brought Zainab, his wives, his children, and his brothers with him. Like the day of Mubahila, it was again a matter of clarifying the truth and promoting Islam in the real sense of the word. That shows the importance of promoting Islam. If someone come across a ruthless sultan who mixes up halal with haram and breaks his promise to God, they deserve living with the sultan in the hereafter. That is to say, When someone sees such a person, they should clarify the truth through their words and actions, just as Imam Hussein did, and he paid the price for it. Imam Hussein brought his dear ones and his wives and children to Karbala in order to clarify the truth.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum.
أنا لاتشان.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان.
أنا لات.
Why did Lady Zainab insist they go to Karbala upon returning from Sham? February 16, 2009. The late Sayyid ibn Ta'us and other luminaries have maintained that when the captives, namely Zainab and others, entered the desert of Karbala on Arba'een, Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari and Atiyah Ufi were not the only people there. Some people from the Bani Hashim tribe and some of the companions of Imam Hussein had gathered at his shrine to welcome Zainab. Maybe that was why Zainab insisted that they go to Karbala on their return from Sham. She wanted this small but important gathering to be formed there. Some scholars have argued that they could not have made it to Karbala by Arba'een. The late Ayatollah Ghazi has explained in detail in one of his works how it was possible for them to arrive in Karbala by Arba'een.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.